From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you believe in heaven, you may have a lot of questions about how exactly it works.
Do you grow old and young and old and young? Or are you the same age that you were when you died? Or are you always the same age you were when you were most beautiful?
That's Lisa Miller, author of a new book about heaven. We'll meet her today as we look at the afterlife and the colorful history of hell. Also, Carlos Ayer ponders the idea of eternity.
I can't see how anyone on earth could be happy with thinking that this is it. This is it.
But first, David Eagleman. He is a neuroscientist and a fiction writer, the author of Some 40 Tales from the Afterlives. He talked to Anne Strangechamps about all the different scenarios that he's imagined could happen to us after we die. Here's Eagleman reading the title story, Some.
In the afterlife, you relive all your experiences, but this time with the events reshuffled into a new order. All the moments that share a quality are grouped together. So you spend 2 months driving the street in front of your house, 7 months having sex. You sleep for 30 years without opening your eyes. For 5 months straight, you flip through magazines while sitting on a toilet. You take all your pain at once, all 27 intense hours of it. Bones break, cars crash, skin is cut, babies are born. Once you make it through, it's agony-free for the rest of your afterlife. But that doesn't mean it's always pleasant. You spend 6 days clipping your nails, 15 months looking for lost items, 18 months waiting in line, 2 years of boredom staring out a bus window, sitting in an airport terminal, 6 months watching commercials, 4 weeks sitting in thought, wondering if there is something better you could be doing with your time, 3 years swallowing food, 5 days working buttons and zippers, 4 minutes wondering what your life would be like if you reshuffled the order of events. In this part of the afterlife, you imagine something analogous to your earthly life, and the thought is blissful. A life where episodes are split into tiny, swallowable pieces, where moments do not endure, where one experiences the joy of jumping from one event to the next, like a child hopping from spot to spot on the burning sand.
David, the pleasure of reading that story is that it almost does to the reader what you posit. It makes you profoundly grateful for this life that we have.
Thank you. That's sort of the point of a lot of the stories in the book, is they shine an interesting angle on our own lives. And I think one comes away from the book with some notion that maybe this is the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah. It's kind of like unstitching a patchwork quilt and reassembling the squares in another shape. I'm wondering, what inspired you to take on this particular subject matter?
I've always been interested in people's stories about the afterlife because it tells you a lot about who they are and what their hopes and dreams and fears are. And I realized at some point that from a literary fiction point of view, using the afterlife as a playing field within which to explore ideas was wonderfully rich. It was a rich area to figure out the joys and complexities of being human. So my book fundamentally has nothing to do with the afterlife, even though all 40 stories are placed in different possible afterlives. The book is really about being human.
You know, I was going to ask you, given that you're a neuroscientist as well as a writer, one of the things that strikes me about the stories is they tend to remind me that, contrary to what we assume, science itself is a story. It's a story we make up, or scientists make up, to fit certain data sets. You have so much fun imagining different stories to fit the basic facts of our existence. Is this also what you do as a scientist?
That's right. That's exactly it. Science and writing are very similar in that you go into the lab every day and you make up really good stories. Of course, with science, what you do is you make up stories all day long, and then you look back to what we know and you try to build a bridge there. And if you're able to build a bridge then that's progress. And if you're not able to build a bridge, then you've just thought of a really neat, interesting idea. And what I do is I go home at night and I use literature as a channel to further explore those ideas. The part that I've been addressing over the last few years is that both with scientists and with religious folks, there's a lot of pretend certainty that I see where people act as though they absolutely know what the right answer is. I think that's what I was addressing in this book from both sides. The interesting part about what's happened with this book is that it's been really taken up by both atheists and religious folks. And I don't know of another book like that. It's really cracked me up to watch the progress of this. The people who have blurbed the book are some very famous scientists and atheists. And at the same time, the book just was recently named one of the top 10 spiritual books of 2009. So I think it's fantastic. I think I'm hitting a middle ground where it's sort of a celebration of the vastness of our ignorance instead of pretending like I've got an answer.
Well, anybody who can manage to delight both those camps is clearly doing something right. One of the things I really love that you do in these stories is the way you play with scale. So among all the different possible things we can have gotten wrong about creation, we discover all these things in the afterlife. So for instance, there's this story called Angst, in which we discover that we've completely misunderstood the scale of creation. Can you describe that story?
Yeah, in that story, it turns out that what we really are these giant 10-dimensional creatures that stand 1,000 kilometers tall in every direction. And we run these very tough jobs of upholding the cosmos, where we have to build structural support to keep the universe from collapsing. And we do that for hundreds of years at a time. And then every few hundred years, you get a vacation. And we all choose the exact same thing. We choose to project ourselves into these tiny, delicate, three-dimensional little creatures that we call humans. And we take a vacation on the little resort that we call Earth. And what happens on Earth is that we just don't care about the bigger issues. All we care about are things like joy and love and light and the tone of a loved voice and the orientation of a house plant and the arrangement of hair. And those are the things we care about when we're here on Earth. And so when these delicate little bodies wear out, and we expand back into what we really are, these huge creatures, we end up spending our time wet-eyed, looking out into the cosmos, yearning for more meaninglessness.
Now, there's a counterpoint story, Spirals, in which we die and meet our creators who turn out to be much, much smaller than we'd thought. Is there a little bit of that one you could read for us?
Sure. Yeah, I'll just read the opening paragraph.
Okay.
In the afterlife, you discover that your creator is a species of small, dim-witted, obtuse creatures. They look vaguely human, but they are smaller and more brutish. They are singularly unintelligent. They knit their brows when they try to follow what you are saying. It will help if you speak slowly, and it sometimes helps to draw pictures. At some point, their eyes will glaze over, and they will nod as though they understand you, but they will have lost the thread of the conversation entirely. So what happens in this story is you wake up in the afterlife, and all these creatures are surrounding you, and they're all asking you the same thing. They're saying, "Do you have answer? Do you have answer?" And it turns out you find out that we are essentially these big, giant computational robots that were built by these creatures over hundreds of years of them working on it. And the idea is that they made machines that were smarter than themselves so they could answer the question of their existence. And of course, you don't have any answers for them. And what you start to realize as they're questioning you is that we build machines that are smarter than ourselves to try to answer things. And we don't know if those machines have taken on a life of their own.
How does it end?
What happens is it makes them sad because they realize that their project has failed. They believe that we have the answer, but we're too advanced to communicate it at their level. The last paragraph says, they don't guess that we have no answers for them and that our main priority is to answer these questions for ourselves. They don't guess that we are unable and that we have built machines of increasing sophistication to address our own mysteries. You try to explain this to the creatures, but it is fruitless, not only because they don't understand you, but also because you realize how little you understand about our machines.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, that's a theme that comes up a lot, the sadness of the creator. You know, whoever the creator is, the odd little stupid creatures, or God, and you have many different versions of God. You know, in some stories she's a woman, in one she's a married couple. But in most of them, God seems a bit powerless over us.
I thought that was an interesting theme to explore. One of the stories is called Mary, and when you arrive in the afterlife, you find that Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley is sitting on a throne, and she's cared for and protected by a covey of angels. And you find out that God's favorite book is Shelley's Frankenstein. And he sits up at night, and he clutches a worn copy of this book in his mighty hands. The reason, it turns out, is because he has a very deep, painful relationship with the notion of creation, because he created this gorgeous biology, all these fantastic things, and yet eventually he sort of lost control over it. And he couldn't stop all the warfare and so on. And so he now locks himself in his room, and at night he sneaks out onto the roof with his copy of Frankenstein. And he consoles himself with this thought that all creation necessarily ends in this, where it's creators powerless, fleeing from the things they have wrought.
David Eagleman is a neuroscientist and a writer. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps about his book, Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. You can find a link to Eagleman's website on our website, ttbook.org. We'll hear another story from Some at the end of the show. What do you think of Eagleman's stories about the afterlife? Maybe you have some stories of your own. You can send us email through our website, ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to our Facebook page. Coming up, we'll explore heaven and hell as we continue our Hour on the Afterlife. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Lisa Miller is the religion editor at Newsweek. She's also an award-winning journalist in the field of religion. Miller's the author of Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife. And she says the three Abrahamic religions share certain ideas about the concept of heaven.
The shared vision is heaven is a perfect place. It's with God. It's a reward for righteous behavior on earth. All three monotheisms agree on that. What it looks like, they differ. How important it is to their theology also differ greatly. Also, I mean, what I found in my writing and research for this book is that there's a huge amount of difference, not just among the monotheisms, but between progressive and conservative or fundamentalist believers. People who tend to be on the progressive side of the spectrum think of heaven in generally metaphorical / agnostic terms, fuzzy, bordered, inchoate, yearning terms. And people on the conservative / fundamentalist side think of it in very, very concrete terms, so concrete that they may be willing to lay down their lives for it.
I've always wondered whether that isn't because there are such concrete rules to get into that concrete heaven. You better have a concrete heaven if you're going to get there.
Partially, but I also think that it correlates with what characterizes a fundamentalist, for example, as somebody who takes Scripture as the literal word of God. So if Scripture is the literal word of God, then the descriptions of heaven in Scripture are literal. There is a city. There is a New Jerusalem with pearl gates and gold streets and jeweled walls, and Jesus is sitting there at the right hand of God. That's what it says in the book of Revelation, so that must be true.
Did you find that that was consistent within each of the monotheisms that you looked at? Was this difference in perception of heaven on the range from progressive to fundamentalist the same within Judaism, Reform Judaism, within Shia and Sunni Muslim, within all of the different versions of Christianity that there are?
It's absolutely true in all three monotheisms. In Islam, for example, we talked a lot after 9/11 of the 72 virgins and of this idea, which we thought was completely crazy, that, you know, a suicide bomber imagines that he's going to receive the sexual ministrations of 72 virgins upon, you know, detonating the bomb in his backpack. That is something that comes from the Muslim tradition. It's not in the Quran, but it's part of the Hadith, which are the traditions of Islam. It wasn't popular until the Iran-Iraq War, when people were making propaganda to try to entice boys to blow themselves up. And it's a very literalistic belief. But on the progressive side of Islam, there are scholars and thinkers and people who think of those promises and other very literalistic promises in the Quran as metaphorical. I once asked a feminist scholar of Islam whether she thought that she was going to receive the attentions of virgins in heaven. And she just laughed. She said, you know, it's not about sex. Heaven isn't about sex any more than the Christian heaven is about Pearl Gates. It's a poetic way of talking about something we'll never understand. So, yes, all three monotheisms have this split.
And yet, within each of them, and I'm speaking only from my own experience, to be honest with you, it seems to me that the more rules there are, the more concrete the place you're going to. And a lot of those rules seem to have to do with who gets to go there.
Right. I wouldn't say it's about the quantity of rules so much as the rigidity of the rules. I mean, one thing that the Reformation did was take salvation out of the hands of the people and put it back in the hands of God. So in other words, getting to heaven was no longer a matter of saying the right prayers and paying the right indulgences and going on the Crusades and hiring the right priest to say the right mass upon your death, which was a kind of obsession of Christians before the Reformation. Salvation was something that was mysterious and inexplicable and in God's hands. So all you had to do was believe in God to get to heaven. And you could stop worrying about all of the little rules. Now, the rigidity of that, and that's why I talk about rigidity instead of number, is that in today's fundamentalist groups, salvation is a matter of believing in that Jesus Christ is your Lord and Savior. And you will go to hell if you don't believe that. And in America today, you can find people who believe this. And it doesn't matter whether you were brought up Jewish or whether you've chosen not to become Christian. There is no idea that salvation is a mysterious thing that's left up to God. Jesus is the only way. And all three monotheisms have that certainty, too.
You do write in the book that the, and I think your exact words, the question of salvation is the biggest wedge issue among the faithful. And that's what it comes down to, isn't it? The question of who gets to go.
Right. And I found myself really, that I really disliked these theologies that included any kind of human certainty about who's in and who's out. And when I think about that, I think about a woman I interviewed for the book who is a Mormon, and she's been a Mormon for many generations. And as a young woman, she was very devout and followed all the rules. And then as she grew up, she took some feminist theory and wrote some scholarly papers arguing that the prophet Joseph Smith, who is the prophet of the Latter-day Saints, never intended for only men to be priests and bishops in the religion. And she thought that women should have a shot at that too. And as a result of this scholarly work, she was excommunicated from her church, the church of her childhood. And she was heartbroken. And she wasn't heartbroken because so much because she missed the church, although she did miss the church. She was heartbroken because it meant that she would be separated in heaven from two of her sisters who remained devout, and she was very close to her sisters. And it moved me a great deal to think about, you know, if you grow up with this theology that you're striving and striving and striving to go to heaven, and then the authorities say, well, too bad, the people that you love most in your life aren't going to be there with you because of a paper you've written. It's heartbreaking. And I think one of the things about heaven that's so important to remember is that if you believe in it, it's a place that belongs to God, and God gets to decide who's in and who's out. And men, women, any kind of human certainty about that seems inappropriate at best.
And yet I'm sure the argument in opposition would be that God does get to decide, and those people who don't believe that believe that they have heard the word of God.
I think that's absolutely right, but I think that that's a very dangerous kind of belief.
One of the other questions that you explored is what it means to be in heaven. We can have all of these great images of the place with blue skies. That's an image that involves there actually being bodies in heaven. There are people for whom heaven is, forgive me, more ethereal than that.
Yes. One of my favorite conversations was with an astrophysicist at Harvard named Owen Gingrich, and he's an astrophysicist and he's also a Christian believer. And for him, the question of where is heaven was not that problematic because professionally he studies places you can't see all the time, and he is very comfortable with the idea of a universe where the laws that govern our universe don't apply. So this presents no conundrum for him. What presents a conundrum for him is the idea of changelessness in heaven. So we are creatures defined by change, and all we do is change every minute, every day, every second over our lifetimes. You know, we grow old, we die, our appearance changes, our children grow up, we fall in love. Everything we know changes. We lose our memories. We gain new knowledge. What is it like to apply this creature that's so defined by change to a place where nothing changes? How does that work? Do you learn Sanskrit and then forget it and then remember it again? Do you grow old and young and old and young? Or are you the same age that you were when you died? Or are you always the same age you were when you were most beautiful?
Or can you get there and stop asking those questions?
These are silly questions on some level, you know, when you take them too literally. But the church fathers, the people who form the theological foundations of the Catholic Church, St. Augustine especially, really struggled with this. What happens to your body in heaven? How old are you there? What do you look like? What do you get to do? Can you eat food? Can you make love? Do you have your organs or not? You know, do you have your teeth if there's no eating? They really struggled with this stuff, and they wrote some wonderful essays about it.
I don't remember whether this is in the chapter you called Is Heaven Boring, but it applies there, doesn't it?
You mean, what do you do there?
Yes. In fact, you talk to the Talking Heads, to David Byrne, the lead songwriter. And there is that wonderful song of theirs called Heaven. And it essentially says there's nothing to do.
Right. A place where nothing ever happens is the lyric of Heaven. Heaven is a place where nothing ever happens. I came to this at the end of the book. You know, we who are so defined by change and striving, especially in 21st century America, accomplishing things, progress, we work all the time, we want the best for our children. What is it like to be in a place that's characterized by the mindless repetition of pleasant activities, you know, playing harps over and over, singing praises over and over, dancing over and over, even that? What's so fun about that? Now, that's a real question. And when I posed that question to some of the conservative theologians I spoke to, the answer they gave me was very moving, and that was, well, God is in heaven. And if you're singing to God, how could it be boring? And I realized that a lot of the contemporary images of heaven that we see, from The Simpsons to Alice Siebold's Lovely Bones to poems and paintings about heaven now, New Yorker cartoons, for example, God is never in the picture. So we've created these heavens that are these perfect places where we have everything we want and we can eat all the ice cream we want and never get fat. But God is nowhere there. And I think that it's a really important part of the idea of heaven. And if you're going to believe in heaven, I think believing in God is really critical to it.
With all of the people you've talked to, all of the issues you've discussed, have you changed your thoughts about heaven?
I have. I was very ambivalent/agnostic about heaven when I started. I had childlike ideas of God floating in the sky in the clouds when I was a child. And as I grew up, I came to believe that heaven was something like hope, but I really also hoped that nobody would ever ask me the question. Now, I am much more able to say that I believe in heaven and that I believe that heaven, that there's something radical in the definition of heaven. One of the best definitions of heaven I heard in the research for my book came from an Orthodox Jewish scholar at Harvard who said that heaven is a radical act of grace or kindness on God's part. And I thought, okay, so this is not something that is inevitable or expected or you can count on. This is about God doing something supernatural because God can. And I think that's a really important definition. And then the other definition of heaven that I love is this idea of heaven on earth, heaven among the community of believers on earth, whoever those believers are, trying to do what God wants from them. So whether that's farming or painting or justice or writing poetry, or even in the most simple analogy, you know, in the love that we have for each other in our families, knowing that we're imperfect, knowing that we're selfish, and trying as hard as we can to love each other anyway. That's the kind of, you know, the feeling that I have when I snuggle my daughter at 7 o'clock in the morning. That feeling is heaven to me.
It almost puts the lie to Emily Dickinson, whom you quote at the very end of the book, saying, heaven is what we cannot reach. It sounds as though in some ways you've found a way to get close to touching it.
Get close, but I don't think ever quite there, never certain about being there.
Lisa Miller is the author of Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife. John Casey's a philosopher and literary scholar at Cambridge University in England. He's written many books. His latest is called After Lives, A Guide to Heaven, Hell, and Purgatory. Casey told Steve Paulson that while the afterlife is a huge idea in both Christian and Muslim traditions, it does not seem to be especially important for today's Jews.
No, interesting, it doesn't, does it? Yet if you go back to the Pharisees and Jesus, they did believe in something like, and Jesus obviously preaches an afterlife which was adopted by Christians, and it seems the Pharisees believed in something very similar. But yes, among today's Jews, the idea of an afterlife is much vaguer, it would seem, than it is among Christians and Muslims.
How do you explain that?
I don't really know how to explain it. In a way, I would say it's a return to the most ancient traditions in Judaism. Of course, it has been argued by recent Jewish scholars that the break between ancient Judaism and the Judaism of the time of Jesus and just before isn't as great as has been suggested. It has been suggested by some modern Jewish scholars that the most virtuous of the patriarchs don't go down into Sheol, into the pit, in the way that wicked people do. That is to say, they live on in the memory of their people. They live on in the memory of the Jewish people and are described as being gathered into Abraham, gathered into Abraham's bosom. And there is a suggestion that the power of God has some sort of existence, even in the afterlife, and that there is a bit of differentiation between those who will live forever in the hearts of the Jewish people and those who are not virtuous, who really are in the underworld. But still, the ancient Jews didn't believe in bodily resurrection in the way that Christians and Muslims have done.
How would you say the vision of hell differs among the three Abrahamic religions?
Well, I don't think the vision of hell itself differs so very much. And certainly between Christians and Muslims, I wouldn't say there's a great difference. I mean, there's a great difference in the colourful details. I mean, Muslims are very interested in the immediate judgment of the dead person in the grave. And they have two angels which come and interrogate him in the grave as to his faith and his works. Does he have faith in Allah and the Prophet? And has he lived a virtuous life? And he's virtually judged then and there. And then there are all sorts of details about hell. There's this very narrow bridge that you have to cross over the flames of hell, led by the Prophet. And for those who are virtuous, the bridge will be quite wide. For those who are wicked, the bridge will be as narrow as a razor blade, and they will fall off on either side. There are all those details, but the difference, I would say, the great difference between them isn't the details about hell and its character. It's that Muslims and Jews, of course, do not believe in original sin. Therefore, there isn't the idea of being predestined to hell the way there is in Christianity, even though, of course, Muslims do believe that everything that happens is decided by Allah. There isn't a doctrine of original sin and human nature being depraved and therefore one being predestined to hell that exists in many sorts of Orthodox Christianity.
Is sin itself a particularly Christian idea?
I would have said not. I would have said sin in Christianity is absolutely continuous from the idea of sin in the Old Testament, in the Jewish Bible, Hebrew Bible. And the Muslim idea of sin is very similar to the Christian and Jewish idea of sin, except the Christian idea of total depravity, that we are born totally depraved and we need a redeemer whose atonement will make it possible for us to achieve heaven, achieve some sort of goodness that we cannot achieve moral goodness on our own, is peculiarly Christian, I would say. I remember there was a heresy called Pelagianism attacked by St. Augustine, and Pelagius, who was a Romano-British monk, taught precisely that man was capable of achieving the good through the efforts of his own will, whereas St. Augustine taught that the will is intimately depraved and we are incapable without grace of achieving any good on our own. Therefore, of course, without grace, without the atonement, everyone would go to hell. And that is something you don't find in Islam at all, or I think in Judaism.
So given the age that we live in now, particularly in the West, sort of the scientific age and relatively secular era, do you think it still makes sense to talk about the afterlife? I mean, is this a concept that still holds water?
Well, I suppose you could argue that we are programmed, to use that fashionable word, in some way to think about the afterlife. But could one put it this way? Insofar as cultures have had an absolute sense of good against evil, I think they've been very, very inclined to think there must be judgment, justice, punishment, reward, and an afterlife. In contemporary Western culture, perhaps especially European culture, where there's much less tendency to think that wickedness actually exists, that therefore there has to be punishment and justice, a great tendency to feel horror at the idea, as Nietzsche put it, of punishment as an end in itself, which for sure all the ancients believed in and most of the great religious teachers have believed in, then this disposition to look to an afterlife, I think, gets significantly weaker. In other words, I'm not inclined to think that the weakening of belief in afterlife is to do with some intellectual or spiritual advance. It's much more a function of the attitude we take to ethics and to punishment itself.
You're suggesting that our ethical system is maybe less bound to religion now than it was a few centuries ago.
Or another way of putting it is, because ethical beliefs are somewhat less vivid and certainly not absolute in the way they've been in some cultures, religion isn't a very natural way of expressing these beliefs, or they don't find religion as a culmination of the imagination that goes with these beliefs. If we go back to the ancient Egyptians, their beliefs are extremely different from those of the Judeo-Christian religions, but they had an equally vivid notion that life in this world is such drama, the life in this world, it's such a vivid thing, it's so wonderful, that one wants to prolong it in the next world, but that depends upon one living up to all the possibilities offered to human beings in this world. And the Egyptians, of course, didn't believe in things like original sin, but they did certainly believe in sin, but it was the sin of not living according to all the possibilities offered by the sacred land of Egypt, you might say.
And it would seem that modern ideas about heaven still carry more weight than those about hell. In fact, you cite a Gallup poll in which 71% of Americans say they believe in heaven, but only 53% say they believe in hell.
When you say only 53%, if you were to ask in England or France, it would be about
that would be a very high 5%. Number.
And by the way, I think the French Catholic bishops have actually denied that hell exists in the traditional sense.
So, but for whatever reason, at least among Americans, hell just isn't as popular as heaven anymore.
No, but do we need to ask why? Well, you're an optimistic nation, I think.
What do you believe yourself?
Oh, I think I believe what I've got in the book, which is that it's something one should take very seriously indeed. You also want to know what I believe, I'm also torn between that and the ancient Greek and Roman idea that true immortality is an immortality of memory in the minds of other people.
Hmm. You end your book with the sentence, "Our image of heaven and hell is finally an image of how we judge ourselves." Can you explain what you mean?
Yes, I think I quoted Nietzsche at that point, where Nietzsche said, I can actually quote it, "There comes a point of morbid mellowing and over-tenderness in the history of society, which it takes aside even of him who harms it, the criminal, and does so honestly and wholeheartedly. Punishment, that seems to it somehow unfair. Certainly the idea of being punished. Why punish him as well? To administer punishment is itself dreadful." And I think Nietzsche thought that these changes in consciousness, which went with the death of God, are really a sort of weakening of the will, that to not be willing to impose justice isn't necessarily an advance towards enlightenment. It's a sort of skepticism of the will, a giving up of confidence in one's own values. And in that sense, I would say that a true belief in an afterlife, in the way that Christians and Muslims and Jews, perhaps not to such an explicit degree, have believed in, or the ancient Egyptians believed in, very much depends upon there not being this, as he put it, morbid mellowing. And insofar as our society is much less ethically conservative than, say, Islamic society, I would say that beliefs in heaven and hell are naturally much more alive and vivid, much more real assent is given to them in Islamic countries than in the West, certainly than in the European West.
John Casey is the author of After Lives, A Guide to Heaven, Hell, and Purgatory. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What comes to mind when you think about heaven and hell? You can share your thoughts by sending email through our website, ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to our Facebook page. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, Carlos Ayer on the concept of eternity. And David Eagleman reads one more story from his book, Some, as we conclude our Hour on the Afterlife. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Carlos Ayer's memoir, Waiting for Snow in Havana, won the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2003. Now he's turned his attention to a very different subject, eternity. Ayer started to worry about death when he was a child, growing up in Cuba during an era of public executions, as he told Steve Paulson.
I grew up with a lot of violence, even before Fidel Castro took over, the few years before his ouster of Batista. Havana was a very violent place. Not only were the newspapers and magazines filled with pictures of people who had been gunned down in the street, but every night as I went to sleep, just about it seemed, maybe a few nights a week, we'd hear gunshots and bombs off in the distance. After Fidel Castro took over, the violence became of a different sort, mass killings, people being shot live on television. I watched all this. I had relatives who were executed. Once we survived an aerial bombing during the Bay of Pigs invasion. When my mother entered the room shouting, we're all going to die. Those are triggers I can remember that, you know, sort of set me thinking down the path about death.
I can see why. Well, I have to ask, do you still agonize about death?
I'm not sure I agonize over it. I puzzle over it constantly. It just seems so unfair to me. To be alive, whatever that means, to exist, and then suddenly not to exist, that bothers me. I can see getting rid of the body, especially as you get older and the body doesn't respond the way that you are used to it. But I'm always puzzled, really, really genuinely puzzled, and a couple of reviews of the book that have come out have puzzled me intensely. I can't see how anyone on earth could be happy with thinking that this is it. This is it. And a couple of reviews have actually said that, you know, in essence, the book takes up what is really a very bad idea, because we should all be very, very happy with our mortality and the briefness of our lives. And that I can't understand.
Hmm. That is interesting, because I know there are some people who just don't get too upset at the prospect of the nothingness out there, or the nothingness that might come after our lives end, whereas others, you apparently, mm-hmm. are deeply troubled by that.
Immensely. It's the ultimate unfairness and injustice, I think, to be conscious and to be aware of the fact that, there will come a day when you will cease to exist, at least in this form now. And also watching others disappear who are part of your life, whom you love, that's very hard to think that that's it, that you'll never see them again. Perhaps that puzzles me more, that anyone would be happy with that arrangement, than the thought of one's own existence coming to an end.
Well, it will take me back to ancient times when these ideas of eternity started getting worked out. I mean, Plato, the great Greek philosopher, was one of the first who had this idea of some eternal realm. What did he think?
Well, for Plato, our earthly existence is really a come down from our previous existence in eternity. He doesn't go into how this happened, but we human beings end up being trapped in our bodies here in the material world, which is an inferior state of existence. And in many ways, it's this Platonic conception, which in and of itself is based on earlier Greek thought. But it's this conception that becomes, in essence, the Christian idea of eternity, that this world, because it's in constant flux and there's pain and death and suffering, and we all come to an end, is inferior to some other realm, higher, in which existence is eternal.
Well, it would seem that maybe the biggest difference between the Christian view of heaven and the earlier Greek view of the afterlife was this idea of salvation. I mean, basically, to get into heaven, only the worthy souls will make it.
Right. It's keyed to one's behavior in this life. One's eternal being is determined by how one behaves while one is alive on earth. So that puts a lot of weight on one's ethics. In the 18th century, when many Europeans started denying not just the existence of eternity but of God altogether, those who did so, like Voltaire, for instance, wondered out loud whether people could be encouraged to behave as good citizens without some notion of eternal justice, or of justice beyond this life.
Without the threat of damnation.
That's right. And in fact, we seem to have gotten along fairly well, although there are notable exceptions. Places that have gone totally awry, I think precisely because of their materialistic focus, places like Soviet Union, the Third Reich, and present-day China.
Let me just follow up on that, because that's a very provocative statement that you make, and you talk about it a bit in your book, that totalitarian regimes do not have a concept of eternity, of the afterlife, and you think they're worse off because of it.
Yes, definitely. I think it helps. The largest argument I make in the book is that the way we think makes an enormous difference on the way in which we live, that ideas actually have practical outcomes. Totalitarian regimes completely devalue the individual. And what we treasure so much here in the United States and in the West in general is the idea of not just individual integrity of every person, but individual rights. Totalitarian regimes have a way of wiping that out because, in essence, human society is not much different from an ant colony. And there's no point on the horizon beyond the present, or the 5-year plan, or the 10-year plan, or, as in the case of the Third Reich, you know, 1,000-year empire. But beyond that, there's nothing, and the individual really doesn't matter, because doing away with one person is the same as sucking up a dust mite with your vacuum cleaner.
The other great strain of modern thinking is that many people have lost their faith, and the whole idea of the afterlife can seem slightly ridiculous. You call this the postmodern period. And I guess it raises the question, as the idea of eternity is slipping away, have we lost something valuable?
I think we have, but I think we've also gained some advantages over previous ages. We have proof of the fact that belief in the afterlife is a lot like nuclear energy. It can be used for good. It could be used for evil. You know, while I think a lack of belief in an afterlife did in fact help the Third Reich to become what it actually did become. On the other side, it's belief in an afterlife that led the 9/11 terrorists to crash their planes into buildings and to kill not just hundreds but thousands of people. And we keep seeing it week after week, suicide bombers in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Israel.
And you're saying take away that promise of the afterlife, that you will be rewarded in heaven, then, and those people are not going to commit those suicide
I acts. Think it will be much harder to motivate people to do that, yes. There's a definite religious component to our present-day suicide bomber phenomenon, and that is the dark side of belief in an afterlife. One thing I've learned by studying religion for 35 years is that religion is no different from anything else that we humans live with, create, and employ. It's a lot like a knife. You know, you can use it to peel an apple. You can use it to cut somebody's throat. Religion, it's the same thing. A belief does not necessarily lead you to a single conclusion, but it does make, pardon the pun, a hell of a difference whether you believe in hell or not, and heaven too. So my conclusion in the book, I really don't say whether we're better off or not, but I really do believe, and I do say this, that we have lost something. We have. We've gained a few things, perhaps a good number of things. But we've also lost what I think is most crucial for us as human beings, which is to value every life as something that is not just a little blip on a timeline, but it's something that is, in essence, way above and beyond what it seems to be. Once a person dies, they're dead and gone. Dust to dust, ashes to ashes. You don't see them again materially. And if you lose that hope that there's something beyond that point, life becomes much smaller, much less significant, at least for me. But I think also for a culture and for civilizations in general, it's much easier to lose sight of the value of every individual when you think that all they are is a collection of cells and electrical impulses, and that's all there is.
Carlos Ayer is the author of A Very Brief History of Eternity. He spoke with Steve Paulson. We started this hour with David Eagleman reading the first story from his book, Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. So, what better way to finish the show than with his final story? Here's David Eagleman with Reversal.
There is no afterlife, but that doesn't mean we don't get to live a second time. At some point, the expansion of the universe will slow down, stop, and begin to contract, and at that moment the arrow of time will reverse. Everything that happened on the way out will happen again, but backward. In this way, our life neither dies nor disintegrates, but rewinds. In this reverse life, you are born of the ground. At funeral ceremonies, we dig you up from the earth and transport you grandly to the mortuary, where the birth makeup is removed. You then are taken to the hospital, where, surrounded by doctors, you open your eyes for the first time. In your daily life, broken vases reassemble. Melt water freezes into snowmen. Broken hearts find love. Rivers flow uphill. Marriages re-ride rocky roads and eventually end in erotic dating. The pleasures of a lifetime of intercourse are relived, culminating in kisses instead of sleep. Bearded men become smooth-faced children who are sent to schools to gently strip away the original sins of knowledge. Reading, writing, and mathematics are expunged. After this diseducation, graduates shrink and crawl and lose their teeth, achieving the purity of the highest state of the infant. On their last day, howling because it is the end of their lives, babies climb back into the wombs of their mothers, who eventually shrink and climb back into the wombs of their mothers, and so on, like concentric Russian dolls. In this reverse life, you have blissful expectations about what will come next as you experience your story backward. At the moment of reversal, you are genuinely happy, for while life must be lived forward the first time, you suspect it will really be understood only upon replay. But you have a painful surprise in store. You discover that your memory has spent a lifetime manufacturing small myths to keep your life story consistent with who you thought you were. You have committed to a coherent narrative, misremembering little details and decisions and sequences of events. On the way back, the cloth of that storyline unravels. Reversing through the corridors of your life, you are battered and bruised in the collisions between reminiscence and reality. By the time you enter the womb again, you understand as little about yourself as you did your first time here.
David Eagleman reading the story Reversal from his book Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 523A. It's a Wonderful Afterlife. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to special guest engineer Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.